Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. China and Russia veto a U.S. drafted resolution on Israel-Hamas war.
I think it's unfortunate that the Security Council as a whole is failing to lead the world in this regard.
The U.S. Senate holds a hearing on instability in Africa's Sahel region. Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau marks 25 years of graft busting, but analysts are not impressed. 500 miners in South Africa resurfaced after spending 3 days on the ground in a suspected hostage situation. M23 rebels in DRC denied attack on East African peacekeeping forces. Uganda offers amnesty to ADF rebels.
The terrorist ranks of ADF who would want to surrender, then they will be given amnesty in accordance with the law.
And Zimbabwe says it lost in excess of $150 billion to sanctions. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. At the UN Security Council on Wednesday, Russia and China vetoed a U.S.-drafted Security Council resolution on the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas in the Gaza Strip. The resolution, according to Reuters, did not call for a complete ceasefire, but a pause to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza. Meanwhile, hospitals in Gaza warned on Wednesday they will have to shut down if they do not receive more fuel and other supplies such as water, medicine, and food. Professor Sipho Sipe is a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me it is disappointing that the Security Council is failing to lead the world in time of crisis.
Well, I think it's unfortunate that the Security Council as a whole is failing to lead the world in this regard. What you have is postures that are nationalistic. This is almost a political bickering. And one must also accept what Ecuador was saying, that when you have a crisis, sometimes you do not have to bicker on the perfection of statements, but to put people's life first, that countries will differ and they can work on the draft and try to perfect it. But by the time it is perfected, that will be too late. And this is the concern that members who are not in the Security Council are expressing, that as the leadership that has taken upon itself to guide the world fails, many lives are lost. And there's a sense that all parties agree that there must be cessation of hostilities. There's a sense that all agree that there should be humanitarian aid. There's a sense that the Palestinians and Israelis' lives do matter. But the way there's also a difference is the notion of that Gaza is an occupied territory. And I think it is that nuance difference that makes the parties to disagree.
Professor, why do you think this difference exists between these resolutions at the Security Council?
Well, the point is that the U.S. has already taken a position on the notion that the Israeli was responding to a terrorist attack. And Russia responded very quickly to say, we do condemn terrorism. And we also are of the view that the notion that says we should not push for ceasefire is also part of the problem. The U.S. seems to be concerned about the Israelis' right to respond. But the other countries are also saying that must also be put in a context. It cannot be as simple as that. If you listen to the Arabs, they are very clear about the notion of occupied territory. They are very clear about the notion that, yes, Israeli must also in their condemnation of Hamas in terms of terrorism. But they also do not think that the attacks have been proportionate, that any loss of civilian life must be a concern that the Security Council must lead. But when you don't address the issue of ceasefire, then you are allowing the side that has power, a military supremacy. to continue to batter the other side.
Professor, where do you think African countries stand in this dispute?
Africa will always be impacted because even African countries themselves are divided on the matter. There are African countries that have taken a soft posture on Israel. And you have countries like South Africa who have been clear that they're on the side of Palestine. So the divisions in Africa does not help in terms of having a homogeneous voice.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg, South Africa. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee this week held a hearing on the implications of instability in the Sahel and West Africa on U.S. foreign policy. Viewer Douglas Umpuga reports.
Since 2020, there have been coups in Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Chad, and Niger. Mali and Burkina Faso have actually had two coups. At the same time, there has been an alarming increase in terrorist attacks by militant Islamist organizations. In his opening remarks, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Ben Cardin, said the committee will examine this recent wave of coups and violence.
So today we're going to examine this recent wave of coups and violence and what it means for U.S. policy. The challenges are great, but we must acknowledge the current trajectory is grim. It requires a critical evaluation of our policies. Congress demanded that when we passed the Trans-Sahel Counterterrorism Partnership Act.
Senator Cardin explained that although junta leaders have justified their coups by pointing to their elected government's failure to improve security, they themselves have failed to deliver as well. In both Mali and Burkina Faso, security has sharply deteriorated and civilian deaths have skyrocketed. The spiraling security situation, he said, is already impacting coastal West African nations, and the committee is trying to find out what is driving this dynamic.
It's hard to say our security assistance has been effective in the Sahel or in countries in West Africa. We certainly have very little to show in terms of the improved security, stability, or stronger democratic institutions. And quite frankly, there is an uncomfortable truth in all this. Across the Sahel, the United States trained militias and militaries were responsible for the coups. We have trained the very people overthrowing civilian governments. So it's critical that we take a brutally honest look at our approach to date.
The senator noted that the presence of the Russian Wagner mercenary group presents an additional serious threat and noted that ultimately the course of history in other countries is up to the people who live there. However, he added that we have the responsibility to at least do no harm through our approach and stand in solidarity along with millions of Africans with democratic aspirations living in dictatorial regimes. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee is in charge of leading foreign policy legislation and debate in the Senate. It's generally responsible for overseeing and funding foreign aid programs and funding arms sales and training for national allies. Douglas Impuga, VOA News, Washington.
The Ugandan government has granted amnesty to the Alliance for Democratic Forces, also known as ADF rebels. Information Minister Chris Bareyumozi, however, said the government won't stop pursuing the rebels until they surrender. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
The announcement was made by Uganda's Minister of Information, Chris Bareyumozi, on Wednesday afternoon.
So we have put a window of amnesty that in case there are those recruited into the terrorist ranks of ADF who would want to surrender and abandon that senseless fight against innocent Ugandans, then they will be given amnesty in accordance with the law.
The ADF is considered by both Uganda and the U.S. as a terror group affiliated to the Islamic State. The rebel outfit, formed in the late 1990s, is said to have killed thousands of people in Uganda and DR Congo. More recently, the government said the ADF were responsible for killing two foreign tourists and their guide in Uganda. In June, the rebels killed dozens of students and abducted others in the southwestern district of Kasese, which borders DR Congo. Solomon Asimwe, a professor of international relations and security, welcomes the amnesty extended to the rebels.
These are Ugandans, terrorists, and they have issues they are raising. Therefore, it is incumbent upon the state to look for ways of reaching these people so that you deny them the recruitment mechanisms they have by maybe moving some people or answering back rightly whatever they are asking. To me, in the right direction.
Uganda and the DR Congo recently entered into a pact to fight the rebels.
The hand is still on, and they will be pursued until when they get defeated, the way Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army was also defeated.
The Lord's Resistance Army, another rebel outfit, mainly operated in the northern part of Uganda and was responsible for thousands of deaths before they were scattered to South Sudan, Chad, and Central Africa. The government has not provided the timeline for the expiration of the amnesty. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Barty in Washington today. It's Thursday, October 26th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. M23 rebels in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo are denying they attack East African Community regional forces, resulting in the death of a Kenyan soldier earlier this week. Instead, M23 spokesperson Lawrence Kayuka tells me DRC government forces have been attacking M23 positions and civilians in violation of the ceasefire.
The things that are happening lately, we have a trend of attacks against the aircraft, which is East African Regional Forces. We have the first attack happen in Togo against the Sudanese contingent. The second one happened Rukoro against the Ugandan UPDF. And the third one happened yesterday against the Kenyan contingent. These are DRC government forces that are attacking all this cohesion of East African Regional Forces. So these attacks came from the DRC forces, which is a coalition of FRDC, which is Congolese National Forces. You have FDLR, they are Interahamwe, the people that committed genocide in Rwanda in 1994. You have mercenary, European mercenary from East Europe. So these attacks has nothing to do with M23.
But your forces have also been accused by the DRC government of being responsible for killing civilians.
I think anything you heard from DRC government is actually a massive lie. Not long ago, you actually know yourself because you've seen it through the social network. Over 160 people killed by DRC government in the town of Goma. We don't kill people. People come to our end. We had people in Bwiza that came to seek refuge from us, running away from the DRC government coalition forces. Those people were attacked again. And we have at the moment a crisis in Bwiza that we're actually calling all the time humanitarian. And if you see even the communique released yesterday, we were talking about people being abandoned by the community of humanitarian.
Lawrence, there should be a ceasefire. And it seems that no one, like your group, is respecting the ceasefire.
I think this day is not like our father's time where maybe there was no record. These days you can go to internet without telling the name of any operators. You can have information. The M23 signed the ceasefire on the 7th of March as requested by the region and international partners. It was requested by everyone to sign by the DRC government never signed. There's no evidence of it anywhere. The M23 still believe and reiterate right now the need for a peaceful resolution of ongoing conflict.
That was Lawrence Kayuka, political spokesperson for M23 Rebels. He was speaking with me from Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. In Malawi, the country's graft-busting body, the Anti-Corruption Bureau, or ACB, says political interference has been among the major elements that have stifled efforts to fight financial malfeasance and mismanagement. The agency's director, Martha Chizuma, says this at a televised media briefing on Wednesday as the ACB commemorates 25 years of operation. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In Malawi, the Anti-Corruption Bureau started its operations in 1998 as an independent and autonomous government body with the core function of investigating corruption in public and private institutions. Martha Chizuma is the Director General of the Anti-Corruption Bureau in Malawi.
In the past 25 years, the ACB has registered and processed a total of 36,878 complaints. Out of these complaints, 10,615, representing 29%, were recommended for investigations, whereas 26,210, representing 71%, were closed or referred to other institutions.
She said many of the complaints were closed because of lack of evidence. Chizuma said political interference is among the major elements that have long stifled efforts to fight corruption.
Political interference is not only in Malawi, it's probably across the globe in as far as anti-corruption fight is concerned. But I always say it's how you handle that political interference, where you will stand on the statutes, and for us, the ACB is supposed to be independent, whether you will be able to overcome the political interference and still stand.
She, however, said the Bureau has recently made efforts to stand against the problem.
If there was ever a time when we have really tried to depoliticize anti-corruption fight, it could be the recent years, starting from 2021. Because the philosophy that we decided to adopt was to deal with the current corruption swiftly and severely without considering which political party.
She cited as an example the arrest of Malawi Vice President Saulos Chilima last year for allegedly receiving kickbacks from the British businessman Zoneth Satam in return for awarding Malawi government contracts. Chizuma also cited the arrest of a bodyguard of former President Peter Mutharika in 2020 for allegedly helping Mutharika avoid nearly $7 million in import duties. Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera has long said that his administration will never interfere in the fight against corruption. George Peel is a former lecturer of political science at the University of Livingstonia in northern Malawi. He says there is nothing for Malawians to celebrate because there are a lot of corruption cases involving high-profile politicians, which the ACB has failed to conclude.
They have failed to investigate conclusively the cases. For example, the case of former President Bakiri Muluzi, which was thrown out by court. Secondly, we had a case of Cashgate during the Joyce Banda administration. That case has not been concluded up to now.
The ACB arrested Muluzi in 2009. On the accusation of diverting an $11 million donation to his personal bank account when he was serving as president between 1994 and 2004. But the High Court freed him in May of this year, citing a lack of interest from prosecutors to conclude the case. However, Chizuma said delays in concluding the cases cannot be blamed on the ACB alone. She said some factors would include adjournments by the courts, a lack of resources, and the need for more investigations on the matter at hand. For VOA Africa, I am Lamek Masina in Blantyre, Malawi.
More than 500 miners at the Gold Worm Mine in Spring, South Africa, have resurfaced after spending 3 days underground. The National Union of Mine Workers, which is the officially recognized representative of workers at the mine, accuses a rival union of holding its members hostage to force the management to recognize it. However, as Tuso Kumalo reports from Springs, the rival group says the workers staged a voluntary sit-in to demand the recognition of their union of choice.
Families, friends, relatives and co-workers who spent 3 days waiting for the 563 workers to resurface burst into song, dance and ululation as this group of miners emerged and joined them outside the mine. The miners looked exhausted, dehydrated and fatigued as they returned to the surface Wednesday. One who declined to be named told VOA that they decided to stage a sit-in to force the mine to recognize their preferred union, the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union.
What we want here, it's simple. It's AMCO and NUM. Us, we want AMCO. So those guys here, they don't want us to be in part of AMCO. That's why we are standing underground.
The National Union of Mine Workers, or NUM, is the officially recognized organization representing the miners. A MCU spokesperson, Luvon Chwati, accused the NUM of lying about a hostage situation.
That's a false narrative, and it has been perpetuated by both management and NUM in order, you know, to get sympathy from the community, in order to get sympathy from anyone around the country. The situation at hand is that we enjoy overwhelming support from the workers.
However, Mpho Phakedi, NUM Deputy General Secretary, told VOA there was no voluntary sit-in.
It was a hostage situation. Majority of people who were held there, it was against their will.
The Gold One Mine legal representative Ziyad Hassam told journalists the workers were held under duress.
Several of them have given witnesses to both the police and to ourselves, and they've confirmed that they were being kept against their will and they were not allowed to come out.
The matter is now before the Commission for Conciliation, Mediation and Arbitration, where the AMCU is arguing that it is now the majority union at the mine and should be recognized as such. Workers belonging to AMCU have signed a petition vowing not to return to work until the matter is resolved. In 2012, wage dispute by workers at the Lonimin mine in the northwest resulted in 34 miners being gunned down when police intervened to disperse the striking workers. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Springs.
Zimbabwe's vice president on Wednesday said the country has lost more than $150 billion due to sanctions imposed on the country's leadership by the European Union and the United States following reports of election rigging and human rights abuses in the early 2000s. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, some economists say that figure is questionable.
Speaking to protesters rallying against sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe's leadership, Vice President Constantino Chiwenga said the measures were actually hurting the entire Southern African region and the country's economy. He called the sanctions an albatross around Zimbabwe's neck as they included financial restrictions that isolate Zimbabwe from global access to capital.
Since 2001, we estimate that Zimbabwe has lost or missed over $150 billion through frozen assets, trade embargoes, export and investment restrictions, from potential bilateral donor support, development loans, IMF and World Bank balance of payment support, and commercial loans. This has forced our gross domestic product to contract drastically in the two decades that followed the imposition of these heinous and illegal sanctions.
After the protest, which attracted many civil servants and ruling ZANU-PF supporters, Chiwenga vowed that Zimbabwe's economy will prevail over the sanctions. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Thursday, October, for this Wednesday, October 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guests this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, saying have a great day and please be safe whatever you do.